Hey, got the morning show with Aaron, and in the studio I've got Finn Maxey. Good morning.
Good morning.
We're here to talk permaculture with Finn, and today it's the design principles we're going through at the moment, and we're talking about apply self-regulation and accept feedback.
Yeah.
And my immediate comment was, that sounds like personal advice. And your thoughts?
I think it's relevant at multiple scales, including the personal. But yes, I think if we reflected on ourselves as a society, we would also have lots to learn from applying this principle.
Yeah, applying some self-regulation at the moment would be handy in a number of places, I feel.
Agreed.
Yeah, but it could be a while before that starts to happen. And accept feedback. I guess if you don't apply self-regulation, you're getting more and more negative feedback, and eventually you'll have to pay attention.
Yeah, and so that might be a good place to start, and I might have spoken to this previously in some of our permaculture chats about the principles, but there is a difference, I guess, when we're thinking about the concept of feedback from a systems perspective. It's maybe not totally intuitive, so I guess we often talk about, you know, giving someone positive or negative feedback. And when we're thinking about from a system science point of view, positive and negative feedback means something quite different.
Right.
And so I think this is maybe important to understand when thinking about how to go about thinking about this principle and using it in our lives. So so in a day-to-day context, I guess when you get positive feedback, someone says, oh, your hair looks nice today, or oh, you're such a good person, or whatever that might be.
Yeah.
In a systems point of view, positive feedback is a type of feedback loop where things amplify or accentuate over time. And so,
and that can be for better or worse, I guess.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, it's just a statement of what's happening rather than an opinion or a...
That's exactly right. And so I guess we can think of long-term, you know, climate change, you know, what the term global warming is, I guess, a reflection of that, the greenhouse effect. So as things warm up, that creates things to warm up. And so things get warmer and warmer and warmer because, you know, as things warm up, we have more glacial melt. And as we have more glacial melt, there is less reflective light bouncing back into the atmosphere, and therefore the atmosphere warms. And as the atmosphere warms, we have more glacial melt, et cetera. So that's
it's a process that feeds on itself.
That's exactly right. And again, as you said, this could be positive or negative. It can be good or bad, not to confuse my language. And so some examples of, you know, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer is one of those common examples or statements, I guess, to reflect a positive feedback loop.
Oh, yeah. I think there's another one people use, which is to make a small fortune, it helps to first have a large fortune.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
And
which is not necessarily true, but it's reflecting that.
Certainly, I think
it's reflecting
the
positive feedback.
It is, absolutely, and that is there is something in that, right?
There is something in it,
And things like, I think AI development is another example of that. So right now, it seems to be the meme or the cultural narrative or the people who are in the AI space, as I understand it. I'm not an expert in this space, but is. To try to reach, I guess, general intelligence artificial general intelligence. If we don't do it, someone else will, so we need to do it. And so there's this big race now, or this drive to be the first people to, or the first company to develop certain aspects of the technology. And so everything is amplifying towards it, and there's not necessarily, in my judgment, a voice of reason saying, what are the implications of this culture and society?
Isn't Elon Musk the voice of reason at the moment on this one?
Oh, I really hope not. I don't know anything about that. But for anyone who's talking about colonizing Mars as the solution to our current human predicament,
I knew that
worries me.
I knew that would push a button, but that was a bigger button than I thought. He has been issuing warnings, but there's also a lot of hysteria about AI as well, which is not very helpful. Interesting though, there's positive feedback. One of the things they're talking about, the AI bubble, they're talking about like the .com bubble, where there was positive feedback.
Yeah, absolutely.
Until all of a sudden there wasn't.
Yeah, that's it.
And it all fell off a cliff financially.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's possible that's what will happen with AI. It'll still be around.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm thinking of it more from a range of reasons, but there's an energy component to it, you know, where we're increasing our energy consumption exponentially through the use of AI. And so we're putting more pressure on a diminishing resource. Yeah. And then there's, I guess, social, cultural, and even psychological implications of it that I don't think have been considered at all. Mm. But that's just, I guess, one example. I didn't say that to suggest that that's necessarily inherently a bad thing. It's just that when we have these technological developments, everyone's racing to be the first in or the first to, you know, you want to kind of market capture and all these other yes. drivers, kind of game theory that influence and accelerate the development of these technologies. I guess another obvious one historically would be the arms race following or leading up to World War One. Is this idea of, you know, wow, they've got a big army now. Oh, or we need to build our army to protect ourselves. And then a neighbor goes, oh, they've got a pretty big army. Oh, we need to build our army to make sure that we're safe. And then, you know, it keeps going, yes. it keeps going. And then eventually you have to use the weapons because you've invested all this time and effort into building them. And you create more and more tension as your army builds and builds. And so the arms race was not the sole factor, but I think historically most people would agree the major contributing factor to World War One was the fact that Europe was full of these very large armies yes. with very sophisticated technologies that they'd invested a lot of their economic power in developing. And so yeah. there was an inevitability in using them.
And you can and also, I think from that, this is slightly different, but they've learned that if you want to have security, you don't get security by having the biggest army. You can't have security unless everyone feels secure.
That's right.
And by building the biggest army, you make everyone around you feel very insecure.
Yeah.
And yeah, and that's what that was. And they're all playing catch up and passing. And the sensible people now, you'll hear comments like, you can't have security unless everyone has security.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. And I don't know if that's a permaculture principle.
You
could tie it in somehow, but...
Yeah, well, I don't know that...
You can't have one thing dominating... Can you? That's not a biodiversity or an ecological principle.
No, so I think that would be for me more about balance.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I guess an interesting example that ties into that and leading into negative feedback would be the nuclear proliferation during the Cold War. And so you had basically, you know, the Soviet Union and the United States building larger and larger nuclear arsenals.
Yeah.
And then at some point reason kicked in and people on both sides went, this is insane. We're kind of ensuring mutual
destruction
here.
Several times over.
And so then negative feedback kicked in that situation and both sides started talking about dearmament and accords were starting to be signed and there was, significant political moves made to cool the tensions and to reduce the likelihood of nuclear war. And so when things got too hot, as it were, there was a cooling mechanism that was built into the system. And over decades, that continued to cool and cool and cool, and the nuclear threat became lower and lower. Of course, we've kind of forgotten about all of that, and the nuclear risk now is arguably higher than it's ever been, but that's a different story. But I guess the bit that I wanted to share there is a negative feedback loop operates against, so it moves in the opposite direction from the way in which the system's moving. And so I guess maybe a day-to-day example of that might be something like a thermostat or an oil heater or whatever else people might use to heat their homes this way, or you know, a heat pump where you would often have some kind of setter or a thermostat that says, you know, I want temperature to be between this range and that range.
Yeah.
And if a heat warms above that point, then the system will either, you know, stop and turn off, or you'll have, you know, cool air being pumped into the space to cool it down. And it sits within this equilibrium space. And so negative feedback reduces the impact of moves in a certain direction.
So you use the word balance before. You actually want a balance of negative and positive feedback. And I guess
healthy systems always have that.
Yeah, and I guess in the natural world you get that. If you choose some animal species and there is abundant food for it, then that's a positive feedback loop. But eventually it'll grow too great and it will eat too much of the food and then you get a negative.
Yeah, well, so that's often how negative predator prey relationships work.
Yeah.
So you have that offsetting. So, you know, as I understand it, you've got the moa and the poakai as being, you know, the moa was the prey and the poakai, the hast eagle, was the predator. And you had this interesting dynamic where, as in, say, in a good climatic year, you had lots of growth and lots of food for moa, the moa population would increase. And so that was a positive feedback loop. And as a result of that, poakai would have more to eat, and therefore they would have more offspring, and their population would increase. But their increasing population would then predate more on the moa, and the moa's population would decrease. And as a result of the decrease in the moa's population, then there would be less food for the poakai, and they would have less offspring, and some of them might starve and die. And so you have this always dynamic balance within predator-prey relationships where there is a combination of positive and negative feedback loops that ensures that neither species gets too out of balance with the surrounding ecosystem and the food available to it.
And it just can't.
Yes.
It's just not possible.
That's right. And I guess that's in a healthy ecosystem.
Although you could look at it and also say it got to an extreme and then... Yeah, like nothing. You don't seem to have positive feedback loops forever.
No, they typically don't last for long.
But they seem to end in a bit of a crash.
Often, yes, and again, yeah. That's because in the absence of negative feedback, there is that there. You know, it's a jargony term, but overshoot. So they go into ecological overshoot. They go. A system gets pushed beyond some kind of threshold, and then once it passes that threshold, then it changes sometimes forevermore.
So the headline for this podcast interview is apply self-regulation and accept feedback as a design permaculture design principle. So I guess the self-regulation part is where you avoid the overshoot and the crash.
Yeah, and you're using positive and negative feedbacks in a really kind of conscious and considered way. So you're trying to build self-reliance. So again, another one historically from this land that I think is interesting where there is that aspect of applying self-regulation across maybe kind of difference was the musket wars, or at least this is as I understand the story. So you have the arrival of Europeans and the arrival of the muskets, and then what I imagine to be a mutually shared understanding of the opportunity. And so particularly, you know, up north you have Maori wanting to trade and get their hands on as much muskets as they can. And as Ngāpuhi moved south and did damage to their historic, I guess, enemies or people who they had beef with, then the name of the game changed. And it was like, oh, we need to get muskets to protect ourselves and then to be able to, you know, if we have other people who we have grievance with, we want to have muskets when we go to attack. And so muskets kind of swept over all of the North Island and South Island. And then there got to a point where I think a few voices of reason went, whoa, this isn't working for any of us. This is terrible.
Historically, this is a lose-lose scenario.
Yeah, historically, the way in which we resolved this stuff meant that there was limited loss of life and all the rest of it. Now, we're kind of slaughtering each other. And so a series of wānanga were started. You know, I know of ones up in the Kaipara and ones down in the Firth of Thames that were an attempt of rangatira from a range of different iwi from all over the North Island coming together and talking through, this is not good for us. This is not good for any of us. How do we resolve this? And so again, that's for me an example of that apply self-regulation and accept feedback, kind of going, this is not what we thought it was. This is actually, no one is going to win. Like you said, a lose-lose.
So we should have in this modern era with the incredible capacity for science and research and observation and measuring things, we should be able to intervene with self-regulation easily.
Yeah, so I think today it is
hard. I say that knowing that we don't.
And I think there is a superorganism kind of layer to this, is we've got this global industrial consumer society metabolism that drives everything, and then we have, you know, very sophisticated psychologies now that kind of do limbic hijacking and stuff like that. Tell us what we, you know, give us dopamine. And there's all these manipulations and larger systems at play that limit or curtail our ability to shape those larger systems. So I think there's that element. So I think it does have to be bottom up. And that's where that kind of starting with the self and the whānau as a unit for self-regulation is, I think, quite important. So you're right. I think in theory we should be able to, but it is really hard. And so that's one of the, I think, the key insights for David Holmgren in writing this principle was the recognition that it's easy to be controlled by larger level systems. And so the more the local level, the smaller the system, as it were, within larger systems, if you can self-regulate at that level, then you often are able to minimize the control that the larger system needs to have over you to manage.
If we keep with social media as an example, because the positive feedback loop on that has been super powerful, but now people are individually going, no more.
Yeah,
getting that app off my phone. Yep. I might be putting the phone away. So there's
I think that is a reasonable example.
There's also a thing that happens with, like, when a large corporation becomes a monopoly, and there's no competition for Facebook, right? Instagram is not competition for Facebook. It's a different demographic. They start to, they kind of eat themselves from the inside. They use their position to exploit, and then the thing they're providing becomes not as good as it was, not as useful as it was, detrimental. And that always seems to be the case when they get a monopoly.
And so I guess in this example, you know, using the supply self-regulation, apply self-regulation and accept feedback, is you might look at either trying to create parallel structures. I mean, that's one of the things about something like Facebook that's useful, at least for someone like me, is it enables me to stay in contact with a whole bunch of global networks that I can't stay in contact with in that same kind of way.
Yeah.
So that there is an inherent challenge, but, you know, what about creating something more localized? You know, creating something that you have more control over, or creating something that sits again outside of and isn't like a proprietary or a corporate entity, but something that is more
like your own personal Facebook or your local Facebook, but with a different name.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm thinking of, you know, like what's the Linux equivalent? You know, if you don't want to use a PC or Apple operating system, you know, there's programmers out there who have developed a totally open source operating system. Well, what's the equivalent, you know, for a social media? Is that an option?
If we get into this, I don't think it is. I think people have got to understand that the amount of, like, the best and brightest engineering minds in the world have been put to the task.
Captured, totally. Of
keeping us on our phones or our devices on social media. Like people don't understand just how much effort has gone into that. Very hard to compete on the same terms. I think the competition for social media is real life stuff.
And so again, that self-regulation in that case would be, and I know this is true for me, is instead of that kind of limbic hijacking, put my phone away and go out and socialize face-to-face. And again, they're not equal in a lot of ways, because I, you know, or at least how I use Facebook, I don't use it to usually connect with my immediate local networks. I use it to connect with those far and wide. But either way, is if I had the option of losing myself in whatever it is, an hour of social media, and not coming out feeling any more connected from it, but, you know, being reminded of all the pre-existing opinions that I have about the world and why I'm right and other people are wrong, or some of the other things that social media does.
That's actually the negative feedback, literally, for the process.
Well, that's a positive feedback loop, I think, because it just reinforces my position and my understanding about the world. It doesn't contradict what I already know.
Oh, yeah, but I'm saying that the effect of that, like, people are now finding that to be a negative experience emotionally.
Oh, yeah.
And then, but so that's using the negative word that way, but then in terms of your loop, that becomes a negative feedback on the system, because people are withdrawing.
People are withdrawing from the system, I understand that. So from that self-regulation point of view, I think is a good thing. And so there is that kind of, there's all kinds of things that we can do at the individual and the kind of the whānau level. But I think it's also important to think about self-reliance as a key component of this, and what we can do at, like, community scale. And obviously, you know, Whangaroa is great in that self-regulation space. So we have things like community radio. We have things like a local resource recovery center. We've got the community house. We've got the time bank, Raglan Time Bank. We've got savings pools.
Yeah.
We have all these alternative, parallel, or localized support systems and structures that allow the community to meet a lot of its own needs. You know, we've got the volunteer fire brigade. We've got, you know, any number of different local community initiatives that allow Whangaroa to be more self-reliant. And the more we can do that, the less impacted we are by some of those larger system forces. So, examples would be everything from, you know, decisions that are made by Waikato District Council to Waikato Region Council to New Zealand Inc., you know, all of those. And then there's obviously global layers and whatnot as well. And so it's not to say that we should, this principle is not about doing everything yourself, but it's just recognizing that the more self-reliance you have and the more you can self-regulate, the more freedom, I guess, that exists within that. Because typically, feedback in systems organization comes from top down and bottom down. Sorry, top down and bottom up. And if you can't self-regulate at the from the bottom upwards, then there is a top down regulation that happens. And those are a lot of the examples you were talking about. Is when systems get into positive feedback and they can't control themselves, then there's usually a disastrous outcome to that.
And I think viruses are a little bit like that. Are viruses like that?
I think I don't understand viruses enough, but there's an element of that. But generally, viruses over time become more virulent and less health impactful on humans. But I guess the bits I don't understand about viruses is when you look at like the human DNA, the human genome is, I forget the number, but we're made up of something like a third of our DNA is viruses. And so they have a messenger function about transmitting information, presumably through human populations in a way that I don't understand.
All right, let's not go there. I was just thinking of COVID, but we're going to get quickly to a point where, yeah, I was trying to see if the way it spread.
Yep.
Right.
Was a positive feedback, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that how quickly it spread, and the government's actions were an attempt at a negative feedback response, I think, to dampen and slow down the acceleration of the
yeah, because it's a potential for exponential kind of acceleration,
yeah,
or something like that.
Yeah, but again, I don't know enough about virology to say if that's an example. I'm not sure.
So how do you say we bring our scale back down to your personal property?
Yep,
and you've got a permaculture plot. And how are you when you're designing your property? Are you looking for opportunities for self-regulation and negative feedback?
Absolutely.
Negative and positive feedback loops? Yeah. Like that's part of your design process?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, yeah.
So I guess there's two things. One is as I get to know the microclimates and the general nuances of the land,
yeah.
I'm observing how different plants respond. But more generally, knowing that climate effects and climate impacts from a changing climate are going to amplify, I'm particularly interested in drought-hardy, wet-tolerant, you know, on kind of both extremes, crops, plants, animals that are quite robust.
Yeah.
So, what are those species that will do well in a hot, dry summer and a cold, wet winter? You know.
So you're picking resilient species.
I am. Yeah. I'm focused on, yes, that's right.
I was trying to think of an example of where you deliberately designed something that would provide, I can't imagine what it would be, provide some negative feedback to stop something running out of control.
Oh, well, this...
I guess that's what ducks are for.
Yeah,
ducks will eat the snails and the snails.
Sure. And slugs.
And slugs, yep. Yeah.
So you do want to design in, so a day-to-day example of a negative... Yeah, so I guess an example there is even just planting trees on steep erodible slopes is really good. So when you do have large rain events, the roots can act as almost like a pump or they hold back the water.
Yeah.
And so you reduce flash flooding and significant flooding and erosion by doing that. And also in areas that are prone to flooding or large you know, kind of wet periods that could have damage, is building in either, you know, kind of check dams, weirs, swales, anything that can slow and hold the water to reduce those effects, and certain plants, again, with deep roots that are able to do that. So there's, so that is probably a reasonable example, is how do you reduce the effects of otherwise potentially damaging large rain events. You want to slow sink and spread water across the landscape. So that is a negative feedback response, and you're designing for that to avoid things like large cuts happening.
So yeah, the response. I guess it feels to me like the response to a positive feedback loop is slowing it down, because we were talking about COVID before, and that was what the government was trying to do, was slow down the spread. You're yep. trying to slow down the spread of water.
Yep.
Which sounds like a bizarre comparison, but it's speed is an issue.
It is. And so, but as you alluded to before, is there are positive feedback loops that we want to keep an eye on, but in and of themselves aren't bad. So for example, I'm in the process of establishing a forest garden.
Yeah.
And what I notice as my soils convert from being primarily bacterial to fungal, the plants are starting to grow faster. And as the plants are growing faster, they're creating more shade over the area and reducing the amount of grass. And as they're growing, they're dropping more leaf litter, which is turning the soil, making it more fungally based and creating more leaf litter on the ground. And so all of these things are feeding into a positive feedback of transitioning from essentially a grassland ecosystem into a forest ecosystem. And so I'm wanting to keep an eye on that, but that's a positive feedback that I'm looking for in those areas where I'm converting what is historically pasture into a future forest environment.
But a natural ecosystem, I would expect to have some negative feedback loops at some point. It will naturally head to a kind of a peak ecosystem, which is an established, mature forest, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Without you guiding it, it would do that anyway.
Yes. Yeah.
So the fungal thing is not going to turn into a giant fungus everywhere.
No, that's right. So within that system, and again, that's why your forests self-regulate. You know, all ecosystems self-regulate, and so they have both of those. That's right. And so in a healthy ecology, both positive and negative feedback loops are playing out all the time to keep that system in a healthy, steady state of sort.
Yeah. Yeah, and this really is a message for human beings. Apply self-regulation and accept feedback. The natural world does it anyway.
Yep.
Although it's interesting, because when we mess with it, we end up with other things going on. Like we have this issue of wilding pines.
Hmm.
And that feels like that could be a positive, or weeds.
Yep.
Did you go to the Weed Busters chat?
I did not.
Jeff Simmons and another dude whose name I can't remember, which is not fair because there were two guys. I only remembered one name. There are real concerns, like a lot of vines getting into the native bush,
mm-hmm.
and there's one that'll just cover the forest floor, and so the forest is still there, but no saplings.
Nothing. You don't get the next generation.
The next generation can't grow.
Yeah.
So this seems like it's just going to destroy the forest. Like there is no, that's just a purely positive feedback loop.
Mm.
Or the ones that climb over the plants and kill the forest, it's purely feedback loop.
Yeah.
The only good thing I can think about is the one that covers the forest floor. Is when eventually it kills all the trees, it'll be exposed to sunlight, which doesn't like.
Yeah.
And then eventually.
But even then, that's a destroyed ecosystem. And then that plant, it sounds like, if I understand it, is it will get managed only when it undermines the structure of that forest. You know, otherwise it'll just stay under the canopy cover until the forest actually dies.
Yeah, like that really does fall off a cliff.
Yeah, and so I think what's interesting for me in this space is, and from a permaculture lens, because, you know, as you probably appreciate, permaculture is very much into choosing a wide range of plants and actually quite...
Not into monocultures.
Not only that, but not being, it's not nativist in its orientation. Starting assumption is not that we can't consciously assemble plants and animals together to create new and emerging ecosystems.
Yeah, yeah.
But the key there, I think, is, you know, being an active steward in that system. So actually paying attention and having a relationship with your larger landscape so that those type of variables don't get away on you. So you're not in a situation where now you have the next 30 years of conservation work to try to eradicate or at least manage some invasive species. Mm. And so there is a degree of personal responsibility. And, you know, it's to a certain degree not very compatible with our current life way, which is, I guess, you know, we go somewhere and earn money and then we go home and we might pass through our wider environment, but we're not interacting with it in that particular meaningful way. And so we don't notice those pest plants or pest species that are starting to become a problem. Mm. And then, and we're not necessarily, we don't necessarily have a responsibility to manage those things, you know, sometimes not even within our own property boundaries, but certainly not what's over the fence.
Yeah.
And so there's a cultural shift probably that's required. And again, I know there's lots of active conservation networks and projects, communities within Whangaroa and, you know, nationally and globally, but how does that become more normative where I'm responsible for the health and well-being of my wider environment, you know, with my neighborhood environment. Mm. And that I think would change significantly. For me, that is, there's an element there of apply self-regulation and accept feedback. But again, there's a disconnect between, we're not reliant on our immediate environment to provide for our needs right now. And so, we're not really,
there's a disconnect. Yeah. Yeah. You know, like you say, I just picked on that particular issue because we're talking about how the natural systems do self-regulate.
Hmm.
But that's an issue of where we've, humans have transplanted something to a place it shouldn't be, and there is no negative feedback loop on it. There doesn't seem to be a negative feedback loop on it.
Well, so I think that's a timing thing. I mean, stepping way back,
would eventually, if we waited thousands of years, would we eventually find a fully functional ecosystem again?
Yeah, almost certainly. Yep. So I mean, zooming way back, is humans have had an enormous impact on almost every landscape we've ever gone in. So the only example I know is the Sanak Alut from the Aleutian Peninsula off Alaska. And so they're an Alut peoples from the island of Sanak. And they have, because of the unique nature of the geology and ecology there, they have done, I guess, archaeological, paleontological research. And they know that there is no evidence of a single local extinction since the arrival of the Alut people. And so they had this very sophisticated way of observing their environment, and as one resource or food source or species in their environment became at risk, they adjusted what they were doing and adapted to rebuild or to enable that species to recover from whatever disturbance had happened. And this is over millennium.
So this is, okay, so this is people.
These are a culture of people who have, but the reason I'm sharing this as an example is it's an extreme example of humanity moving into a new environment without significant environmental impact. Whereas I don't know of any other example anywhere around the world of, and humans are migratory, you know, we've moved all around the world, and almost always, at least from my understanding of the archaeological and paleontological research, is we impact. And so we disturb, and this isn't unique to humans, but we disturb the local environment when we move in. And then over time, we either do one of two things. We degrade the environment and then move on, make it, you know, more or less hospitable. Or we stick around long enough to then, you know, maybe a little bit controversial to say, but to indigenize, to become of place, such that we become essentially keystone species within that environment. We become active stewards, and we have a significant role to play in managing the health and well-being of that system. And those systems typically recover. And very sophisticated, usually, ways of land management, of ecological land-based management, evolve and develop.
Yeah.
And so,
and there's some fascinating stories about that. But I was just curious about, in my hypothetical situation, the forest that's destroyed by vines.
Yeah.
And will somehow natural processes one day, maybe millennia later, will there be a fully functional peak ecosystem there again?
Yep, almost without exception. I mean,
Yeah.
And depends on what you mean by peak ecosystem, but the system will, depending on what happens, will change, and it might be a new normal. So when we look at, you know, the so-called fertile crescent, of which, you know, agriculture is said to have emerged, or in
yeah, which
the
looks
Middle
like
East,
it's kind of like a desert now.
Which is now a desert, but it is a stable ecosystem. So it's very different. So if you're talking, if the question you're asking is about, will a new normal emerge such that that system kind of optimizes the potential for life to be in that environment, I'd think yes. Will that necessarily look the same way that it did before, or will it have the same amount of abundance and fertility? Not necessarily.
Like I've in this hypothetical situation, which is, it kind of seems possible when you look at what the potential for weeds to destroy forests is. The entirety of New Zealand is just covered with vines, and they're at like a foot high because they can't grow up anything because they've killed everything they could grow up.
Yeah,
is that a functional ecosystem in itself? And is it going to evolve back into bigger things?
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of dynamics that play out there that means that I guess we can only speculate. So all living systems, we understand it, move through this kind of, it's called the adaptive cycle, but predictable stages of growth, development, release, and renewal, and they move through that fairly predictably. And then there's the for loop and the back loop, and there's a whole bunch of theory associated with it. But all ecosystems kind of change and evolve. And so it doesn't quite answer your question, but New Zealand has been a forest for a very long time. And although most of New Zealand has been submerged over the life of its development and emergence from Zealandian coming up, life has been able to bounce between the islands and the parts that were above land to maintain a lot of our unique flora and fauna. And once it reemerges, those submerged parts of land have reemerged, they have reemerged back as forest again. And so it does seem like the pattern language for Aotearoa New Zealand,
for this climate,
is a forest system and our soils and all the rest of it. So over longer periods of time, that might change. You know, when you look at Australia now is kind of the other end of life, right? A very leached, depleted landscape that's been around for a lot longer, much, much older.
But their soil is very old.
Exactly. And so so the time frames are different, but you could imagine a time in which Sahul or, you know, previous stages of what we now know as Australia would have been much more temperate, much more forest-based.
Well, they could have had tropical forests there. Like,
they still do on the latitudes.
Yeah.
But yeah. But yeah, they would have been more extensive. So, you know, some of this is about time scale, but if your question is more about do ecosystems recover from positive feedback loops that run away, they do, but that doesn't necessarily result in a better, more optimal, or even similar to what it previously was. The system changes forever, and sometimes they can recover and create a new norm that is similar enough to what it was before, and other times that's just not how it plays out. And there's a whole bunch of other variables too, like what might happen in your scenario of the vines. What I imagine is then as the forests die, there's a whole bunch of carbon stored in there. They become much more vulnerable to forest fire. And as a result of that, then you might have significant burnings that that then change the soil conditions and disturb the ecology enough where there might be a new ecosystem that emerges in that space. But again, I'm speculating.
But we do know that burning can be a natural part of an ecosystem, like regular burning.
Oh, and again, this is what I was sharing about before from this apply self-regulation, accept feedback, is lots of indigenous and traditional land-based practices involve controlled burning because they know that's how they maintain the health of those ecosystems.
Yeah.
And there's other benefits that associate from, you know, people meeting their needs through whether it's hunting or soil fertility and all the rest of it. But that's, I think, where, you know, we have a role to play in our environments to help maintain the health and well-being of the system.
Alrighty, we've reached the end of the show time. Is there anything you wanted to add, any important bits? Or
I mean, we alluded to it, but I guess the only bit there is that kind of personal responsibility. And
that's where the self-regulation comes in.
Yeah, and what are those things that we can do? And this isn't, you know, we've spent a lot of our time talking about ecosystems and forests, but this can be everything from, you know, how we, where we spend our money, how we spend our money, what we, how we spend our time and the things we kind of quote unquote consume, whether that's again in the social media space or what we watch. There's a whole range of things, and those all impact on our quality of life. And I think the kind of the balance, our ability to kind of self-regulate. And so, I mean, it's not something we don't know, but as you alluded to, there are lots of things in our world today that are designed very sophisticatedly to kind of undermine our ability to self-regulate and to make meaningful choices in our life. And this principle is really speaking to or reminding us that actually we can have quite a lot of autonomy if we bring a degree of consciousness and an understanding about what's happening around us.
Mm. All right, Finn, thanks for coming in.